Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up Podcast. Solly here, not an emergency podcast that many are you calling for. With Phil's statement, apology, or whatever was released today, the news of KPMG dropping him. Just wait. We'll wait till Sunday. There's going to be more news this week. A lot of things will happen. Did get a great chance earlier to speak with our friend Max Homa. This conversation is probably pretty obviously recorded before Phil's statement that came out today, but we talked a little bit about all the ongoings in the SGL, PGA Tour, all these things, and had a conversation about, you know, what he's hearing from players, what his qualms may be, how it could possibly be addressed. Great conversation with Max. Really enjoyed chatting with him, as always. Excited to also hear that my Rogue ST Triple Diamond LS head has arrived at the Kill House. But did you know that in addition to the stock black and gold color scheme, you can actually customize your Rogue ST driver through Callaway Customs? That's for all the heads, the Max D, the Max LS, and the Triple Diamond LS, all eligible for customization. You can make any kind of colors. They have 5 different zones. You can customize 8 different color options you can choose from, and you can customize the tungsten speed cartridge, the soul channel, the 2 individual jailbreak medallions, and the crown accents. For you minimalists out there, you'll appreciate this. There's a new clean crown option, which features no alignment aid or crown accents. Visit CallawayGolf.com/customs to see how you can customize your Rogue ST driver or Jaws full toe wedge for that matter. Again, that's CallawayGolf.com/customs. Let's get to Max Homa. So tell me you walked around Riv with a little bit of extra swagger as the defending champ this past week.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it was weird to be in a group with DJ and Adam Scott and not feel like weird. I would even honestly argue, like, just with the fans back, like, I had the most support. DJ's, I played with DJ there 4 years in a row now, and he's usually, you know, got a big following, and he still did, but it was different. It was the first, I felt very eerie kind of, but it felt like comfy, which was fun. But that, I don't know, that place definitely gives me a little boost, and then the city with all the fans, it really helps. So it was cool to like walk around with a little swagger, a little pep in my step, and you know, it was a for a 10th place is as much fun as you could have losing by, I think I lost by like 9. It was the most fun I could have had doing it.
But it just in that answer right there, it seems like you're kind of you're trying to come to terms with your stature on the PGA Tour, right? Yeah. You've won 3 times now. You're paired up with DJ and Adam Scott. It's not, you know, it's not out of charity that they're pairing there. You're defending champ there, but like, get the sense that you still don't feel like you fully belong in that group, but you kind of feel like it, but you don't. What's that like?
Yeah, I guess you're right. I think I do. Like I said, play with DJ the last 4 years there, like literally at that tournament helps, but it's never been Thursday, Friday, it's Saturday, Sunday. But like Adam Scott and DJ are 2 of the best golfers ever. I was like trying to think about, you know, just putting their careers into perspective, just thinking about how they're still 2 of the best golfers in the world, but like they are 2 of the best ever when you add up all that they've done. So that's just, I think that would always be a little weird for me just to be in that group. But I definitely feel like once I'm on the golf course now, I don't feel like overwhelmed by like what they're doing. I think before I was probably a little bit more like in awe a bit. I remember the first time I played with DJ there, I was in awe of him, but he is, you know, tremendous golfer. But I'm definitely kind of trying to get that. It's weird when I play with the younger guys like JT, you know, Berger, Jordan, kind of like, I don't feel as, I feel like that's where I'm supposed to be, 'cause those are the guys I grew up with, you know, like, I mean, JT's probably, I mean, Rom's pretty damn good, but JT's like the best golfer I've really seen day in and day out, but I've seen it for so long. And for some reason, when I play with them, I don't feel like I have that like kind of, man, I'm in JT's group, which is good just because, I mean, like I said, we turned pro at the exact same time and I'm comfortable with him. I'm in awe of his golf game, but you know, it's not the same as, I don't know, for some reason, like Adam Scott. I mean, I was talking to him about your guys' podcast or whatever, and it was just funny talking about like how he came up, you know, as the next like Tiger and how difficult that was. And it's like, when he was saying that, it was just putting in perspective how long he's been out here like really doing well, like dominating out here for the most part, or dominating is a tough word when Tiger was around, but just like really like putting his stamp on the game. And so when you play with those guys, it just kind of, it just still feels a little different, but it doesn't feel like uncomfortable. It just, it's still cool, I guess, to me. Like I still really enjoy, like that pairing was very cool and it was very fun. And Adam Scott's super handsome, so it's just kind of fun to like trail around with the guy.
Did you ask him why he's wearing a brown sweater, like, or the tan sweater, like literally every day this week? And Monday he wore it?
To be fair, I did not see it Monday. I only played with him Thursday, Friday. And I mean, it, for 2 days, it doesn't sound crazy. When it's like all 7 days and then eight into his charity or into his clinic the next day, then I would have asked him if I was with him all of those days. He did. We did have a funny one. Our lockers are next to each other. And he had shaved. And Sunday after the round, he's getting his stuff together. I'm getting my stuff together. I'm like, hey, come on, man, you shave. Like, I thought we were a band of brothers. And he was like, oh, you know, I got something to do tomorrow, so I shave, but I'm going to grow it back after that. He's like, actually, I think I might grow a little mustache like you've got going. I said, whoa. I said, don't steal my thunder, man. Like, you're already the best looking guy out here. Give me something.
Please no. What, in your definition, you know, maybe some of this may be obvious, but I'm curious to hear your answer. Like, what is the difference between you and them? How would you define that? Either at their peak or now, or how would you make that comparison in golf game perspective, of course?
Yeah. DJ's different than Adam. DJ has, DJ has that brain of DJs that really, it's remarkable. Cause this was the first time I played with him where he didn't play well really at all. He had like a 3-hole stretch where it was clean, but he didn't play terrible. He didn't look bad, but he was looser than normal. He wasn't driving it great. And he makes this double on 10. It got a bad lie in the short bunker. Kind of caught it skinny, went in the back bunker, got a horrible lie, like one bounce side spun and basically buried under the lip, pitched that out, didn't get it out, or pitched that into the bunker, didn't get it out of the bunker, makes like a six. And it was, you know, a long hole. And me and Adam, you know, like we were fine with whatever, you know, and I think I made a two on that hole.
Oh,
and
casual.
I was talking to Joe. I'm like, I'm going to tell my grandkids I just beat Dustin Johnson by four on one hole. and honestly, DJ comes over and he's just immediately like, God, like, you know, like, that, you know, that bunker, he was so fine. Like he was so okay with what had just happened. And that is different than anybody I've ever been around, because then he just went back to his business. He continued not to play like great golf, but he did not play worse because of that hole. You know, he was the same human being. And then you add in that he has some of the most like freak talent of anybody you'll ever see. How high he can hit it. He can hit kind of every shot if he needs to. He has something about him that's a little like, we always talk about there's very few things people do that I'm like, I can't do that. There's very few, there's a couple shots here and there that like P. Reed will hit around the greens. That's like kind of silly. And then there's some, you know, obviously like a driver from Rory is pretty outrageous, but like DJ does that stuff. And that's different. Adam would be a more comparable person to like answer that question too, because what Adam does is he's obviously a great ball striker. He's a good short game. You know, his putting, he's very good outside of like 6 feet, but he has like an area you could see, like, you know, he would like to improve, as everyone does, I guess. But the thing about Adam is he's so consistent. Like when someone says, man, Adam Scott's a great ball striker, like pretty much every time I've played with him, he's been a great ball striker. And for the most part, like I'm playing with him, obviously not in his prime. So I imagine back when he was doing it, like at the highest level, like that was a thing that was a staple every single week. It's like kind of when I first came out and played with Charles Howell III, everyone's like, that guy's a great ball striker. And it's every time you play with him. When I played with Rom, it's like, he pretty much is good at everything every time you play with him. So it's like the consistency of it. There's a few guys out there that have that like kind of crazy, like, how are you doing that? But it's not a lot. A lot of it, when you get to like closer and closer to the top, you just see that when you hear that they're good at something, you see it like that day. There's never like, oh, he had an off day with that. I think that's the difference. And it's just an all-encompassing game. You know, like Adam Scott is, First time I played with him was at the Masters last year. And, you know, you always hear about his iron game or whatever, and it was fine. It wasn't the best I'd seen, you know, for him. Like, I was expecting, you know, maybe too much. But like, his short game was dumb good. And I was shocked, but it, like, obviously it makes sense when I think about it. I'm like, dude, this guy's made, I don't know how much money on tour, like playing golf. Like, he must be good at everything, but like, you don't hear about that a lot. That's what I try to tell people about the PGA Tour. What's interesting is, like, every single person out there is really good at something, but almost everybody's good at just about all of it. And the top guys are great at pretty much everything. And that's like the big thing. And that's a day in, day out type thing. So that's always interesting, but I don't know. I feel like I'm getting to the point where, like, I'm not, I see where I could beat people and this and that, but it's the sustained, like, excellence at those things that make people be a Dustin, a Adam Scott, a JT, a Rahm, all those guys. I think that's a big difference.
Because it seems to me, I don't think there's quite enough chatter about what I would just call, like, repeatability, you know, and how your very, very, very good iron shot is not different than Adam Scott's very, very, very good iron shot. Or let's take Colin Morikawa, who's the best iron player on tour. Yet, if you do it 14 times around, he might be doing it 16. And that is where, in my opinion, like, that is where the gap is in professional, at any level of golf, is like, you just, the frequency at which you're able to do it and rely on it under the gun is just something I don't hear a lot of chatter about.
That's 100% what it is. And that's definitely what is getting, for me, where I'm seeing, like, my growth, and then where I'm seeing areas that I need to improve in, like, why I need to improve them. Cause there's, like, my short game is what holds me back from, like, the next big jump. Right. And when I watch most guys, like, short game is, it never leaves you, right? Like, you don't have good and bad weeks. You kind of just always have a pretty good week. Like, the strokes game would only get off if, like, let's say you plug in a bunker and you don't get out of the bunker and all of a sudden it gets skewed. But for the most part, like, it's always like that. I'm seeing that more and more with my ball striking. I'm seeing that, you know, on days where it doesn't feel great, it's still very good with the strokes gain type stuff, and this and that. But it, over the course of the entirety of your game, like Jordan Spieth, I always say this. My mom would always say, "Oh, Jordan is, like, kind of lucky. He makes so many long putts." And I said, and she's, like, kind of getting, you know, in the last 5-10 years, she's gotten into, like, the golf thing. So I try to explain, like, his ball rolls by that hole like a foot and a half every time from 40 feet. I said, "Mine's sometimes short, mine's sometimes 3 feet long. Like, do you know how not lucky it is that his are going in?" He's giving himself, he's repeating, like you said, he has the repeatability to make that, make the ball going in the hole have the highest chance so often that it's like, dude, he's going to make more than all of us. Like, it's not luck. It's like, he's putting himself in the position to do that. And when you watch, like, Adam Scott hit an iron, or DJ hit an iron, or a driver or whatever, it's just like, you keep hitting good drives, you keep hitting good iron shots, it wears somebody out at the end of the day. And that's kind of what they do. And that's why, talking to Adam about Tiger, I talked to him a little bit about, like, you know, kind of what you guys had talked about, and how hard it was kind of coming up and being compared to him. And he said, like, the thing is if you got close to Tiger, Tiger was just so much better than everybody at everything. And, like, DJ even talked about it on Friday. I think he was like, dude, Tiger's, like, short game, you know, he's like, Phil got all the publicity, but he's like, I mean, Tiger's short game was unbelievable. Like, he said, it might've been better than Phil's. And it's like, every single area, he's so good. And he can repeat that every week, that if one area does kind of fall off a little bit, you have this whole other area to pick you back up. And that's where those guys that are top 10 in the world, like, to me, that's what they do. It's a week in and week out thing. And when something's off, they have something else that is repeatable. And I don't know, that's how they do it. Like, for my game, like, I can't speak to everybody. For my game, what I see is, like, I'm a very good driver of the ball now and a good iron player. So if I do that over and over again for 4 days, it adds up. I can feel kind of times where I'll play with somebody who I know is not, like, has been kind of struggling in the season or in their career, like, a little bit. Obviously, we're splitting hairs on the PGA Tour. And I know, you know, they get off to a good start or whatever. And I just have a little bit more of that understanding because I've been watching these, you know, top 10 guys a lot more up close, that, hey, just keep doing your thing for 18 holes. And, like, you know, you're not going to get that loose, and maybe they will. And that's how you can kind of have a little bit of more confidence in how you're going to beat somebody. And those guys have been doing that for like 10, 15 years. So that's what's crazy. 20 years for Adam, you know, it's wild. So I think that to your point, that it's the repeatability. It's the, obviously things are going to get off here and there, but I mean, it doesn't get, Adam had like 6 whole stretch on Thursday where he was hitting it, honestly, not very good. He was just hitting these high hooks, and it's, first off, really frustrating to watch that from that golf swing, because it makes you realize that golf is truly impossible.
Yes.
But then he got clicking, and you guys watched that. I mean, he ends up getting, I think, 4th or whatever, and he played unbelievable back end of Thursday and then all into Friday and then what seemed like the weekend. So that's the thing, is that those guys are just, they're off is so not off. And, you know, doing that for that long is wild to me.
Well, it kind of has clicked for me. I think this year we've Ben and I have done like a little system where we do, where we go after your round, every full shot you hit, give yourself a 0 or 1 grade, like, and just add them up. And like, the only way to actually get better at golf is by accumulating more sustainably good, is by accumulating more good full shots, right? Like, you just can't rely on, if somebody's hitting it to 15 feet all day and you're hitting it to 30, you're not going to beat them. Like, you can't make enough putts from further away to offset that. And it's starting to accumulate for me, because I've followed you guys obviously for many, many, many years, and I still struggle to like explain or understand what makes up the difference, right? I mean, because you tune in, you see Jon Rahm hit a bad drive. You see him plug one in a bunker every now and then. Then you look up at the end of the tournament and he's 18 under. And it just is this relentless kind of, you know, consistency of hitting it to 10 feet, hitting it to 12 feet, hitting it to 15 feet that just adds up at the end of the day.
And I would say too, is what I've seen, and this goes for weeks where, like, I'm assuming for Rahm would be the best example, just because he plays so well so often, and then has a week like this week where he doesn't play great, but it's still good. The difference is sometimes that if you hit, let's just say you hit in a day like 35 full shots, and you hit 30 of them well, if there's gaps in when you hit them well, like they're not strung together at times, that's the part that's frustrating. Like, you'll hit a great drive and a mediocre iron shot, but then a great iron on the next par three, and then the next hole you'll hit like a okay drive, but you'll hit a good second shot. It's like they need to string together. So the better you are as like a ball striker, those streaks come faster or come more often, and that's a big thing, because you can hit almost equally as many good shots as I hit in a day, but if they're not back to back to back for like 6-7 in a row, it's going to be hard to beat me, because I'm going to go make 2 or 3 birdies on those holes, and you're going to still make par, and it's going to be okay. The art of golf, though, where those, like, you know, especially Rahm, like, what's amazing is when he does rarely hit a bad golf shot, he has a way to make that par, get out of dodge, and then start that streak over again and just get back to hitting great shots. Then you look at people like Justin, who can hit a few bad drives in a row, but has all the creativity in the world and skill in the world to hit these amazing recovery shots or pitch it in. And then you add like a whole new element where it's like, man, you didn't even hit 2 good shots on this hole, but you just made a birdie or made the easiest par you've ever seen. So that's like kind of like the nuance of them. But yeah, it's just over the course of 72 holes, it's just, it really is keep your head down, keep hitting great golf shots, and just wait for it to click where like the ball gets really close. Cause you can hit on Sunday, I hit a few really great iron shots that were off by, you know, especially when it's firm, as you know, you guys know better than anybody, like it has to be almost perfect to get a ball close, especially at a golf course like Riv. And it's like, I hit a few shots where they were, if Joe had to ask me, how'd you hit it? Like, do you match everything up? I'd say it was a 10 out of 10. Like, I cannot do better than that. And I have 40, 50 feet. And it's like, you know, maybe on Thursday, Friday, I hit that same shot and it was going to like 5 feet, 10 feet. And it's just like, that's the hard part. But it's like, if I keep hitting, making that golf swing, I will hit it close at some point. Because like, you know, obviously over the course of time, like the ball's going to get closer. You know, if you're missing by a yard or two, sometimes you're going to get it on the right end of that. But that's the part, is like, just keep hitting good golf shots and then add them up. But yeah, I mean, to your point, like Jordan Spieth was known as the guy, like I referenced, as somebody who just makes a million long putts, but he was also the best iron player in the world for 2 years. So it's like, he's had more opportunities than all you guys, like, or all of us. Like, it's not, had some magic was like the part of like the putting, but he was due for those putts to go, and he has a million of them.
That makes a lot of sense. What you just described there about Riv, How different is that from normal PGA Tour stop? I mean, it's something that it pops to me on TV only through years and years and years of watching it and appreciation for the different shots that are required when it is firm. And it may not be the most entertaining golf to everyone that watches on TV, but it's great for me. So what is it like to play tournaments in those conditions?
Yeah, I mean, it's so much fun. And I think the kind of maybe misnomer is that the pros like kind of sometimes when it's set up soft or whatever and not too hard, but it's not true because like this week was a perfect example. When we saw the weather report, when we saw it was kind of windy Monday to Wednesday, everyone was like, this is going to be fun. Like this is going to be a true test of golf. And it turns out like that you see the leaderboard and that's exactly what it pans out to be. It's great because you really do get value for hitting a shot pure. Like when the greens are that firm and they tuck pins, you could take your chance. You need to hit your number and you need to hit it solid because you need some spin to stop the golf ball. And it really shows you like guys who have the most control over their ball that week. You know, I played in front of Colin on Sunday and JT and Scotty Scheffler. So three of the best, like, you know, ball strikers in the world. And you could hear the roars on certain pins. And I'm like, dang, like that was a great shot, but you also had to have the confidence to go for it. And that's what's cool about Riviera is you can hit that golf shot. Joaquin showed it. You can hit the golf shot. But if you miss it, you're going to be in a world of pain. So that's fun. It's also just Riv is the hardest part people don't get about Riviera is the Kikuyu short of the greens, you know, like in the fairways, the ball will not bounce up. So if a pin is like four on or five on, let's say, and that ball lands six short, you will be putting from the fringe from six short. But if you land it one short of the pin, you're going to be bounding past the pins. But if you hit a great shot, lands one to two on, that ball will get close. And it's just like, do you have the guts to go for that? Do you have the, you know, skill to go for that? And then
the eighth hole is perfect.
Oh my God. I mean, you have that. That's one of my favorite par fours in the world because the tee shot sets up options and angles. I always play down the left because I believe that like the angle to the front right pin, which is clearly the hardest pin, it's still a hard, hard golf shot and you're hitting more club in. So I go up there, but DJ and I had good drives on Thursday. He bombed it. He had like 60 yards in, but he was on a slight downslope. I was on a flat to maybe upslope from like 80, so I could spin it more, but I was still aiming like 20 feet left of the hole and trying to cut spin it back. So I'm like hitting like a creative wedge shot, but I'm also very okay with where I ended up, which was like 25 feet. DJ basically had to just bail long, long left. And like, he had almost nothing from where he was. He would have had to hit the perfect golf shot to stop that thing anywhere near the hole, if he even could have. So he has to take it way past the hole. And next thing you know, now, you know, we both have putts for birdie, but you know, that there was, you would have had to really, maybe on a Sunday, if it was your last hole, you could try to hit that golf shot, but it's typically a no-go. And then you all of a sudden have a back left pin. And if you're in the fairway, you can take it and kind of try to land it on the downslope, but you got to spin the hell out of it to do it. And if you miss it again, if you're short, it's going to roll back down the hill. You're going to have an awkward pitch shot. If you don't spin it enough, it's going to go kind of over the back of the green, which would have been okay. But it's like all of a sudden you're thinking about all these things and it's just a wedge, you know? So that's the interesting part. Whereas when we play a course where we get a lot of rain, like one of them's Minnesota for the 3M, like it's a pretty fun golf course, but we always just get rain that week. And anywhere a pin is, if I'm in the fairway, even sometimes in the rough, I could be like, hey, if I feel like I can hit my number, I can just go right at this thing. And if I miss the green, because it's still soft, it's like I don't have a huge penalty. Whereas here, you know, because chipping is so awkward around the Kikuyu or whatever, you really don't want to be off the green too much. And it's just, it's a constant battle, but it's also, you know, that good golf is going to get rewarded. You just have to keep doing it and keep being smart, but it's just so much different. You know, like your land numbers are so, so important. And the execution of hitting the golf shot pure is so important. It is amazing that Tiger never won here. Every time I walk around this place, I'm like, man, like the best guy should win this week, like typically. And he obviously plays the best golf the most often of anybody ever. So it's like, you know, the quality of his irons or whatever, but I heard he said in the booth, he just played like shit. So every time he played here, so I guess that makes sense, but I would have thought, you know, this place would be a stomping ground because it really values so much good golf. Where some other courses, you get away with hitting one skinny, it lands by the hole, takes half a bounce and stops. Like you can get away with that and then, you know, roll in a 15 footer. Out here, if you don't hit a great shot, you will not hit, have 15 feet. It's just not going to happen. You even look at the most remarkable thing. JT lays up on 10, which I didn't even think was a thing anymore. And he hits like this unbelievable cutty, like 60, 70 yarder. And it just shows just how skilled he is at everything, but at that right there, because that is abnormal, man, to be able to do that. Like that takes, I don't care, it's 70 yards. You need to hit your number. You need to hit your line. And that thing better be spinning like crazy. Cause every shot into any green is hard to stop. And that one, especially. So that's remarkable in its own right. So, but yeah, that's everyone. I think that's why Riviera gets so much praise. But the cool part about Riv is even when it rains and it gets a little soft, it's still hard because now it's playing longer. And now you're having to hit those shots with a little bit more room for error because of the softness of the greens, but you're hitting a 7-iron where you might have been hitting a 9 to the same size sections, obviously. And it's tough, man. It is difficult. You get a little ocean wind and all of that becomes very daunting, I guess.
A quick break here to check in with our friends at Cash App. You can use code NOLAYINGUP, all one word, at Cash App and get a free $15. All new users get a free $15, and Cash App sets aside $10 for each sign up to Youth on Course. So you are paying for a round of golf for a junior golfer. All you have to do is sign up. Not only that, we're going to be running some contests in the future. Basically kind of encouraging you guys to send in questions. And if your question gets chosen on the show, we're going to send you straight cash, but you're going to need a cash tag for it. So everyone needs to get signed up now. Cash App is the easiest way to send, spend, and save your money. You can put money straight into stocks. You can buy Bitcoin with it. You can settle bets with it. You can pay bills through it. You can do all kinds of crazy things with Cash App. It's genuinely fun to scroll around on the Cash App. If you can't tell, we've had a lot of fun with it. We're doing all our bets in Bitcoin this year. And again, you get $15 free when you sign up with code NOLAYINGUP. Not only that, $10 going to Youth on Course, the 501c3 charity that we've chosen for the proceeds to go to. Again, sign up, Cash App, promo code NOLAYINGUP. Let's get back to Max Homa.
There's some hard. I mean, that was the thing watching Neiman come down the stretch. Was like, even as good a golf as he played for 3.5 days, was kind of like, dude, you better hit this tee shot on 13. Like, you better hit this fairway on 15. Like, you're going to drop shot there, or you're going to drop a shot there. Like, there's just nowhere to hide. Let's go to 10. What? Tell me about the strategy of playing number 10. Should that hole change? What is it? If I'm looking at it, it seems like it's the ultimate fun to watch, but kind of unfair hole at this point. But at the same time, I can't wait to watch guys come through. What's your thought process on how 10 plays and how you play it?
Every time I think of it, I just think of DJ Pie, the GOAT. It's the hole that's the king of chaos. So I answered it this week in some interview, they said, is it, you know, what do you think about 10? And I said, it's either the best hole in the world or it's the worst hole in the world, and it's nothing in between. It's one of those two. And but it doesn't mean I don't love it. If it is the worst hole, it's not, I don't love it, because I think we could use a little more chaos. If they are going to change something, all like what they have to do is they really just have to, you could do both of these or one of them, but you almost have to raise like a slight like lip in front of the back bunker, because the ball just like, it just keeps trickling. You, it's not like you need it. I hope people don't think I'm like saying you need it to stop it. It's just, you could hit an unbelievable pitch there, like in the tournament, and it just gets onto the fringe and then rolls into the back bunker and then rolls kind of down on the downslope. And that bunker shot is a nightmare as it is. So the second part you could do to fight that, if you're only going to do one, is if you just extended that back bunker's depth, just like another two steps, so that you had just some form of like a flat lie, I think that would be another way to do it. But at the same time, I love it because it's just crazy. I mean, we literally just hit it into the trees some days and just take it. Like, it's the only time I hit a driver on a Sunday, and Joe, I didn't quite cut it enough, but that's kind of what our miss was, because you can't be right. And Joe's a great shot, and we get in there. I have to hit a flop shot over a tree from like 45 yards. If I hit the tree, I'm screwed. Leash was right next to me. He didn't get it far enough. It trickled because of the severity of the green. It looked like it stopped, and now he's like in the most dead spot ever. Doesn't get that on the green. Makes six. But I love it because you can always pitch it to the front right of the green and then work your way around. But that pitch or whatever, like Colin makes that chip right on Sunday.
It's gross.
I watched the video. It was going in the back bunker, I would say, like almost guaranteed, which is an okay spot. All in all, the very back right bunker is actually kind of the best leave if it's a pin in the back. But it's, I think it's a fun hole because it scares the hell out of you, and it's 270 yards to the front. So I think that's good. There's definitely some parts where I'd be like, it'd be nice if it was like a little bit soft, not softer, but like flatter in the back part of that green for like being 6 to 8 paces wide back there. You know, it's also on a downslope and the greens are firm. So it's like, if we want to match all our favorite things, it's like, we all love firm, but then you add that element. It's like, well, now I don't know what to do. If I'm going to like not get it past pin high. So, but I love it. It's just, they could change it. I just think back in the day, it was softer and like hitting a wedge in there wasn't outrageous. Now JT hitting a 60-yard wedge shot that goes onto the green, you're like, wow, that's an amazing shot, which is cool. But it's like, maybe it could be a little bit more room for error, but I don't know. It's a fun hole because anything can happen. I remember 2 years ago when Adam Scott won, Harold Varner was leading. I was the group in front of him and we're all kind of chasing Adam and Harold at the moment. And Harold, I think, popped up his tee shot on 10. We waited. We waited behind the green to watch what somebody looks like hitting a 7-iron into that green. And of course it, you know, I think he made bogey, but it's like all of us stopped to watch the golf shot because we know how impossible it is. So I think that's the fun of it, but yeah, I mean, it could be a shade. I don't know how, like I heard your guys' podcast talking about like that hole and TC saying, I don't know what I really don't know what he would make from short of the green without just using a putter, like a round thing, because the quality of shot you have to hit to stop it on the green from anywhere is like high. Like it's freaking hard. Leishman's got one of the best short games I've ever seen in my life. He clips this, his third shot from behind the bunker off the fairway. He clipped the hell out of it. It was pure, but it came out too low and spinny and it goes in the bunker and he makes 6. And it's like, geez, like it's not like he really hit a bad shot there, but he just made a 6.
That's why I can't tell. I can't tell if I love or hate this, but it seems like it's not a great test of skill. Like I think I actually kind of like, you know, you're kind of just hitting something towards the front left, hoping to end up in a great spot. As good as you guys are, you do not have precision from 290 to hit it like right to this spot where you're going to have the best angle to chip up that green. And that's where it's, you know, I don't know. It's kind of fun to watch just kind of randomized situations to be like, all right, how does he handle this? Let's see what happens. And everyone's got to go through it 4 times.
I like it because it also shows you how you handle like a little bit of adversity too, because it is like, I'm going to use this word because and I don't mean it this way, but just lack of a better term. It is unfair at times. Like, but again, the fair part is you can always go short right again and start the hole over and just add a shot. Like you can just add a shot to your, but like it takes like some, like wherewithal, and it takes kind of some maturity, I guess, to do that. So I like seeing that. But yeah, I mean, at the same time, the hole is like, it's legitimately outrageous, but I mean, I don't know. You get to see some really cool shots there. I mean, Scottie Scheffler on Sunday hit in that short bunker and hit a beautiful bunker shot to like 12, 15 feet. And that's a lot of skill around the green. It's a lot of skill off the tee. It's not, I mean, it's really don't neck it and hit it right. And then if you hit a great quality shot, you could have a putt for birdie. If you don't feel like you can, you kind of then have to take the long way in and try to make a 4 or 5. But I would say that's one of the interesting holes where I'm on that tee trying to make 4. And after I hit my tee shot, then I reassess and be like, okay, you know, maybe we can make 3 now. But most short par fours, you're like, okay, I need to make a 3 here. Where do I leave it to make a 3? This one, you're like, where do I leave it where I'll have an option to make a 4? And if things go really well, like I'll look at 3. It's a tricky little hole, man.
What are you packing a little extra distance so far in 2022? That ball in Phoenix, I know it wasn't humid out there, and that makes the ball go super far. But you look like you're sending it a little bit more this year. If I'm looking at the data on Data Golf as well, you're gaining distance pretty much every week now.
Yeah, we obviously work with Blackburn for a little over a year, and he long-term wanted to get a little more distance. I have like the levers, like I'm pretty tall and I got long arms where I should be able to get it out there pretty good. I've never hit it that far. I've always been above average, but never in that like next echelon of distance, which I'm still not in, but we've all wanted to, but you know, I never had like great range of motion in certain areas, I guess, for distance. Started working with Colby, K Wayne Fitness. He's got, you know, JT and Taylor Gooch. I started working with him because of Taylor. You know, he's the guy who you'll see in pictures with Tiger. That's his trainer. And I mean, we started working together right before the Fortinet. And it's crazy because I haven't really felt like I've done anything different in my swing. And I'm getting it out there a lot further. I went to Titleist like 3 weeks ago before Tory, and there was pretty cool. JJ, who always fits me, and he's on the road with us, had like a spreadsheet of like my comparison of people on the PGA Tour and then the top 50 in the world. And it was in a lot of areas, like apex of iron shots, this and that. But when we got to driver, my average ball speed was actually really high. I think I was like 15th of those 50. And, you know, the top 50 typically, for the most part, minus maybe Kiz, hit it pretty hard. So I'm like pretty close to the top, but my launch angle and my spin were like damn near the worst. I think I was like 48th, 49th. So kind of fitting. I got a different shaft in a driver that would launch it a bit higher and spin it a little less. And all of a sudden, like for those 2-3 weeks, you know, I started seeing these great results and like maybe some work paying off, but without doing anything differently. But it's been fun because I do feel like I can bomb it now. The thing was, is I play with Adam and DJ Thursday, Friday. I felt like a child. Like they were so far ahead of me on some holes. I was like, Jesus, Joe. I'm like, so I go back on, I sometimes go on like that data thing, that the getting their PGA Tour app has, and it'll show your ball speed. My ball speed's still like crazy high for me. And I'm like, God dang, they hit it hard. You know, like I just can't keep up. But it's definitely a part of the game I think I need to have to like jump to like the top 10 in the world. We talked to Brody in the off season, and he said basically like, you know, certain areas I could pick up the strokes gain stuff. That's kind of how he works, is if I could gain, you know, 3 more yards off the tee, it would boost that stat up a lot. Even if I missed one more fairway, just gaining a little bit of distance. So I've been seeing that, you know, my driving has been getting a lot more accurate, and you add a little bit of pop into it, and all of a sudden I can, you know, turn these par fives into really scoreable holes and feel a little more comfortable trying to fly a bunker. I believe that on this tour, and unless they change something, like the 300 to 310 carry is a big deal, because I think it opens up the fairways enormously. And, you know, I was always sitting in that 295 ish area of carry, and the fairways feel like they're the smallest. You have a few guys who can always fly that, and it feels like you can really take advantage of a golf course compared to your counterparts. And I'm getting that a little bit, where I feel a little more comfy. You know, Joe will look at a bunker and be like, that's no problem today. And I can remember back in the day, I had to think about that thing getting over it. So it's been a boost, but I haven't done much different, except honestly, Colby has like just the littlest stuff, hip stability, a little bit of hip strength, a little more range of motion in my arms and shoulders. And all of a sudden, like I can, it's fun to see. I mean, I know you did the speed thing. Like it's honestly fun to do, like just to see improvement in that, and like throw down some sort of like launch monitor and watch yourself be able to pick up some speed. But you got to be careful, because I know a lot of guys, not just tour players, regular people, who I'm like, oh, I heard you're smashing it. And he's like, yeah, but like I can't play from that. So it's like, learn how to play from it. You watch JT has a great way to do it. He gets his kind of heel off the ground. I'll do that here and there. Learning new ways to do that without being crazy. But yeah, it's definitely you know, it's a shout out to the guys fitting me, Mark and Colby, because I haven't really changed a whole lot.
But is it about having a better cruising speed than it is a higher max speed? I mean, that's the only benefit I've seen. It's like, all right, well, my cruising drive is maybe 3 mile an hour faster, and that helps so much. It helps me feel like I don't need to wail on one to crush one. Is that fair at your level?
Everyone's different. I know that's why, or I'm pretty sure that's why Bryson does it, which is, and it's really smart. I had never thought about that. But like when I was at Titleist, Mark had me hit like 5 to 10 drives as hard as I possibly could. And then I just went back to hitting normal ones just to keep testing the driver. And all of a sudden my speed was up like, you know, a couple miles an hour, and that'd be cool. But I don't do it for that. I've always played in like a smooth kind of like tempo feel of driver. Cause when I hit it out the middle, like again, I'm kind of lucky with the length of my arms and this and that I can create a decent amount of speed. I like it more because I'm getting more comfortable swinging hard at it and having a second gear to like fly something, or when I need one to get out there. Like 18 at Waste Management was a perfect example on Sunday, and I think Saturday. I mean, I there's the water is, you know, 295 ish to cover. This other bunker's like 305, 310. And it was a bit downwind, and it's hot and not humid at all. And, And, but I was like, man, like if you know, I'm going to give this one a ride and cut it off that bunker. And I flew the little corner on Sunday. I had like, you know, 75, 80 yards in. And like, for me, I use it more as like a booster. Cause I like playing in that, in the my cruising probably isn't much higher than it typically is. I just have a little bit more go. But I think most people are probably using it so that their smooth is a lot faster, but it feels under control. But part of that probably is, you know, when I'm practicing more with the, with a little bit harder one, I imagine that, you know, I'm less fearful to go at one, maybe even in cruising, maybe a little harder. I'm just not noticing it. But yeah, that's where all the speed training stuff does make a lot of sense. It's like, it's, you know, same reason why, you know, baseball players would swing three bats. It's like, you just want it to feel a little bit easier to get moving, feel lighter. But you know, it's an interesting thing out here because I think there was a huge hype on the distance, the players gaining distance and like getting into it. And you still see it now, but so many of those guys come back and be like, no, I actually like the way I was playing. Like this is messing up little things here and there. I mean, shoot, it can mess up your iron game. So it's a fickle business.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. It's you know, there's some downstream effects to pretty much everything you do in that. Changing gears here completely. It's been, a lot of the topic of conversation around golf has not been the golf that's being played on the golf course. I just wanted to talk to a tour pro this week about what, you know, the last several weeks and months have been like, especially, you have a relationship with Phil Mickelson. I'm curious if you guys have talked much lately. What's it been like to be among these rumors and stories and smoke? And is there fire there of everything that's gone on over the last weeks and months?
I mean, yeah. Yeah, there's been some smoke, and you know, I admittedly don't know a ton. I've been trying to ask around a little bit. I've had more like conjecture with, you know, Taylor and I will talk about it a lot. We always joke pretty much for the last month, every time I see Taylor, he'll come up to me or I'll come up to him and be like, hey, you know, do you want to talk or have you signed an NDA? So, you know, we don't know a lot. We hear things from other players, but
what's that conversation like? What are other players like? You know, I'm so curious about that element of it.
Well, I'll just ask that. So I've just been very curious about this, personally. I know, and I think I know as much as you guys do about like this whole, the captains and what they've been offered and how that's going to work. Like I get that, you know, but that's not new news. The thing that's been kind of interesting to me is they're saying how close the whole thing is, but if they haven't called me and they haven't called Taylor, then they can't be that close. I mean, Taylor's one of the best players in the world. I'm, you know, 30 something in the world. Like we would be in that next conversation. So if we don't know anything, I don't know how close they could be. So we've just been so curious. We've been talking about like, you know, would you do it? What would you do it for? You know, how would that work? Is it worth it? Or do you just want to take where all these guys leave and now we're the head honchos of the PGA Tour? Like we have those conversations a lot. And then we both have conversations of like, oh, I talked to so-and-so this week and I heard that, you know, how the money is going to be distributed, but everyone's different. And like, so I know like little things like that, or I think little things like that. But we also hear the smoke and the fire of like the Bryson and Phil stuff. Like we knew that they were heavy on the topic and heavy on going to that tour. We don't know what that means because again, I don't, from all accounts, it can't be that close. Like it can't be that close to being ready because they need more than 12 guys. And I still don't know who all the captains would be because I know a couple of the people who have been offered captainship and they're not totally sold on the idea. So it's like, it's never felt that close. It did feel close to something like what just happened last week happening. Like you knew somebody was going to come out and say something. I didn't think it was going to be that, but we kind of knew it would be one of those couple guys. I was pretty surprised to hear the Dustin Johnson come out and kind of pledges his allegiance to the PGA Tour just because rumor had it, again, not talking to him, but like that he was going to, you know, be one of the guys to jump ship. So when he says no, then I'm like, man, maybe all this info I had isn't valid at all. But yeah, it's fun to talk about because like the guys who don't have these, the info, it's like all conjecture and it's kind of hilarious because we can play like the fantasy game of like, you know, well, you know, like, Taylor and I would say something like, all right, how much money would they have to offer you? And both of us would say something like, I need more time than money, really. Like, I don't want, even if they gave me enough money in 2 years to kind of retire, I don't want to retire when I'm 33 years old. Like, I love playing golf. And then, but then he'd be like, all right, what if they give you $40 million? And it's like, oh man, you know, now it's a harder question. Right. But obviously that's not realistic. So it's like us playing that game. But at the same time, like, we always have the conversation of, as I mentioned earlier, it's like, T, if 30 guys leave this tour, like, we become like Dustin and JT and Rom, like, very quickly. And that would be really cool also. You know, I thought I answered it all right. And like, what the, kind of my view on the whole tour itself, I think it's a really entertaining idea. I think it would be, if it's done properly, it would be good for golf, because I do think the team thing is really interesting. I've always thought that having maybe jerseys for teams and other sports is what we kind of lack in golf. If you're rooting for Dustin Johnson to win the golf tournament, you want to see him in person Saturday, Sunday. Well, he missed the cut this week, which is rare, but he missed the cut. And now as a fan, you are missing out on one of the most interesting, greatest players to ever live. And in this case, it would be, you know, everyone's playing all the days. It'd be easier to sell. So I think that there's a lot of interest there, but at the same time, like, for the rest of my life, every single time I play Riviera and the Genesis Invitational or whatever ends up getting called in 20 years, it's like, I'm going to have the chills. And I don't think I'd have the chills playing any event over there. Or I know I wouldn't, because there's just not, there's no juice to it. There's no history to it. And that matters a little bit. The reason the Masters is, yeah, the golf course is tremendous. The whole thing they do is tremendous, but it's the Masters. Like, that's why. And it's so, you would miss that. And I hope people keep leaning on towards staying on the PGA Tour. I don't personally believe all these bad, horrible things people, you know, a couple people have said about the tour are really that valid. They may know more than me, but I don't believe that. I've enjoyed my time there. There's definitely things I'd like to change, but they're not things that I would compare to, you know, serious crimes against humanity. So
that's what you mentioned there, kind of the fun game, you know, you guys are kind of joking about $40 million, anything like that. I don't get the sense that there's a lot of chatter amongst tour guys about, like, hey, just like, quick pause on this. Like, is this too good to be true? Like, cause it kind of sounds a little too good to be true. And like, you know, we talk
about that.
Okay. But it doesn't seem to lead the conversation. Right. So that's what I'm trying to get at, is like, all right, one, does it seem too good to be true? Two, like, have we fully thought out about the sustainability of this league? Things like that. Yeah. Three, like, I think it's quite obvious what they're doing with this money and the goal of it. Like, is that a concern among players? I think, as I'm sitting here not being offered that money, it would be, it would be a huge concern of mine. What's your perspective on that?
So we do talk about that. Here's the tricky part. Like, I don't want to come off as like, you know, there's never enough money, right? Like, I get it. I'm leading this as I'm very happy. And I think most of us are very happy with what we make. The issues I think people have with wrestling this idea of like guaranteed money is we do not get guaranteed money out here. Like, sure, the tour has done an amazing job the last couple of years, especially this year, of pumping money into tournaments. We just looked at Joaquin just made $2.1 million for winning the Genesis. That's amazing. The Players is up a bazillion dollars. We're going to, if you play well there, you will make $1 billion. But if you miss that cut, that money does not matter at all. Like, it doesn't matter at all. I'm not blaming the tour. They have to look out for everybody. But the thing is, we have no guarantees that we're going to get any of that pie. If I get hurt, if I just have a rough, you know, couple months, I'm getting none of the benefits of all of that money. So the idea for a professional golfer to get guaranteed money, like another sport where, you know, I got a buddy who plays baseball, he signed like a $220 million deal a couple of years ago. And I'm like, damn, you know, he didn't even have a great season last season and he's still getting that money. And he's still annoyed he didn't play great baseball, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, but at least you got that, you know, you proved what you were worth. And I think all of us out here, if you've had a good career so far, you've proved what you're worth, but you still don't just get that money. And that's it is the beauty of this game. And I do like that. But if you're going to, kind of tease me with a guaranteed amount of a lump sum of money that could, it's not changing my life, as Rory said, but it would make things like comfy, I guess. It's hard to just be like, ah, no, it comes from a bad place. And I get that. That sounds stupid. I wrestle with that thought in my head that I would just say, oh, but it's enough money, you know, but like, we don't get guarantees out here. You know, I could hurt my wrist tomorrow and never get to play. I have a buddy, Scott Pinckney, who's a tremendous golfer, hurt his back, can't really play much golf anymore. And it's like, he was never guaranteed a dollar, and that's tough. So it's just like little things like that kind of keep, it lingers in your head. But so the guys do talk about that. We do talk about the too good to be true, because it does sound like it's a hobby for these, this group doing it, the SGL. And that's scary, because if, I've heard rumors that the way you get paid is, you know, you get a lump sum for the first tournament, and then the next tournament you get a little bit more and a little bit more. Well, if they bail on that after one tournament, yeah, you probably got a lump sum, but those guys have so much money. Like, that's not enough to like basically end your golf stuff, you know? So it's like that people are definitely like a little bit leaning on the fence on that, and definitely questioning it a bit. And I think that's good, because again, I don't want people to leave this, the PGA Tour. I don't want people to jump ship. So the fact that more guys than not are pretty aware of the kind of like icky factor of like, oh, we don't really know how this is going to work. But I'll say that some of the top guys, like they're qualms with the thing with the tour, and it's just the payment, I guess. It's, you know, I know that Phil talks about the rights to his media and whatever. Like, I don't have any value in that. I don't have golf shots that like I would be selling. Like, so I guess that's just maybe a top guy thing, but there's just some stuff like, hey, when a purse goes up on tour, we are all kind of like, oh, that's amazing. But it's like, we didn't actually continue the same percentage that it should be. You know, with I know the US Open years ago, there was a big kind of frustration with the players because they got that new deal from Fox. I think it was whatever it was, our purse went up a bunch, but somebody in the player meeting stood up and said, hey, just so you guys know, like, we should be making $3.5 million to win this tournament if we kept the same scale. And that's just the stuff I think people get bothered by. I know back in the day, you know, the WNBA, there was, they were talking about how they're underpaid. And that's how the headline goes. And I'm thinking, man, like, you know, I don't watch much WNBA. Like, you know, how could they be underpaid if they're not bringing in the value? Then I actually read for once, because I wanted to learn what I was missing. And it wasn't that they were saying that they just deserve more money because they deserve more money. It was that they were making a lower percentage for the whole nut of the WNBA than like the NBA made. Like, you know, these are horrible numbers, but let's say the NBA players make 20% of that money. Like, the WNBA was making 12.5%. It's like, that is being underpaid. Like, you deserve your cut. And so our cut every time these deals go through, from what I'm hearing, is not the scale is not the same. So yes, we all of a sudden make a bunch more money, but it should be more. And I think that's the big guy's kind of problem with it. But I mean, at the same time, it's a lot of money. So it's like one of those sticky things. Like, I don't care so much, but yeah, that's not even what I would change as much as anything. But that's where the guys who are making a bunch of money and honestly, for what they do for the tour and for me and all the players, they deserve more money in that. If that's how they deserve the same scale for however much going forward.
Well, and there is absolutely something to, like, yes, you guys make a lot of money, but you don't want to be underpaid, right? If somebody else is making a lot of money off of you, hypothetically, or if you are, you know, let's say it's not Saudi, if it's the DP World Tour and, you know, whatever, you got 300K that you made this week. But if on the DP World Tour, that would have been worth 700K.
Yeah.
That what would the be hell's pressure. Going on here? Yeah. Like, how is that? How is this happening? Like, there is something to, and some people can label it as greed of like not wanting to be underpaid in that regard. But I would say the same thing. If there was a podcast that was making way more money like than we make and getting way less listens, I'd be like, what the hell is going on here? Yeah. That's not apples to apples, but there is an element to that. And I think it's a hard block for you guys to be on, because it can get, you can get labeled as greedy very quickly in that regard.
We look like assholes when we talk about how we don't get paid enough. And I totally, trust me, I get it. Like, I think I get paid plenty, but to that analogy, like, so I was talking to they had a bunch of, you know, athletes or whatever at the Waste Management for the Pro-Am day. And I was talking to one of my buddies about this lockout. And one of my problems with lockouts in the sports world is always that people always jump on and say, man, so-and-so is overpaid. And I always say, if you took that guy and paid him less money, let's say, whatever you think is his value, that money just goes to the owner. Like, right. So you want the billionaire to make more money.
Exactly.
And he made a good point. He said, you know, all of our, as athletes, income is very public. Like, I can click two buttons on an app right now and you can see how much money I've made in my life on the golf course. But I don't know exactly what everybody at, you know, the tour office makes. I don't know what the CEOs of certain companies make or owners of teams make. Like, I don't know that exact number because it's not as public. I'm sure I could find it, but it's not as public. So for some reason, when the athlete talks about money, we come off as greedy because I get it. There's people at home working their ass off to make, you know, a very, you know, very normal and not
I know what you mean. Yes.
huge amount of money. So I get that. But yeah, so it's like this fine line we have to kind of dance around because yeah, to your point, let's say I was working at In-N-Out and the guy next to me is working at In-N-Out and I'm making $10 an hour and he's making $9 and we're doing the exact same job. It's like, whoa, why? That's frustrating. And then I find out that it's because the owner is taking that extra dollar for himself. Now, I don't know how all that's working. All I know is that the scale of how things are being paid out isn't increasing at this same level or at same speed. And even if it was, if I complain about money, it's just more, we get hammered so fast for it. So we just kind of avoid it. Like, this is probably the most I've talked about it, like outside of like just talking with friends, but it's not that I think that I deserve more money or that whatever. It's just that you just want it to be like, quote unquote, fair. Like, you want it to make sense. You want it to be even. And maybe it is, but I'm just hearing from what the players who have looked up and like done the research or whatever, that's what they're telling me. I'm not freaking out about any of it because again, I like my life. Everything's cool. But yeah, you just want it to be whatever. And that's why you have a league like this with a little carrot above you. And it's like, man, that does sound pretty nice because it feels like, you know, you're kind of getting your worth, I guess. But if my worth is what it is right now, I'd be stoked for the rest of my life. So it's a very fine balance, but I just never understood why the athletes get hammered for talking about, oh, I need more money. It's like, you guys are so greedy. It's like the person who's getting that money has billions of dollars and they're like scraping around like a little bit more. But that's just that's just life. Everybody would like a little bit more money for the comfort, but Rory said it perfectly. It's not going to change your life. It'd be nice, but it's not going to change your life.
But it's also, you know, and I'm curious, you don't sound like you're not a ringleader in any of this. You're just kind of hearing what other people are saying. And I'm honestly curious to hear that because I've looked at the PGA Tour financials and I've heard what Phil Mickelson is saying about how much they're paying out. And there's a big, big gap between what he's saying. And you know, so like, what is the sentiment among tour players do people think that the tour is just sitting on a huge pile of money that they're not giving players for some reason, that the executives are hoarding too much money, that the headquarters, they spent too much money on, the tournaments cost too much money what is maybe missing there? And this can be your words or what you're hearing from other people there.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't. That's a great question. I haven't heard people like exactly say like what we think they're doing with the money. again, my problem is not like if I had to change things, mine would not be the money part. Like I think we get paid fine. But when people tell me what they think, then I'm like, oh, I get their point of view, but that's not what I would change. I mean, I would definitely say that when you build like the super building they have, and you build the players driveway the TPC Sawgrass driveway for however much that was. And then we find out that we're making our purse went up $500,000 to $1 million at an event. Like you're like, okay, that doesn't seem even, you know, like in both worlds, like that doesn't seem even. I don't think that the executives are making too much money. I don't know where that money would be going. It's just, if I'm being paid 50%, let's just say for even, cause I'm not great at math. If I'm getting paid 50% of all total revenue, and let's just say that's $100. And then we find out that we got $50 more into our bank from some TV deal or some whatever, anything it is. And now I'm making 35% of that dollar. Which again, none of this may be true, but I'm just saying, then you'd be like, well, that's weird. And I think that's where a lot of the guys have a problem is the numbers they look into. They don't believe the exact numbers that maybe the tour is showing. And they have all those kind of problems with it. I haven't looked into it, so I don't actually have a problem with that. If I looked into it and I believe what they believed, yeah, maybe I'd be a little bit more perturbed about the whole financial situation, but I'm just hearing what they say about that. But no, yeah, no, to your great question, because nobody ever says like, oh, that, you know, Jay's making too much money. I've never heard anybody say that. Never heard anybody say like Tyler Dennett's making too much money. So I don't know where they think that money is. But there's definitely, you know, there's a couple of tournaments I know that would want to pump more money into their event, but they can't because the tour doesn't want that event elevated above. I mean, that was the whole thing, I think, with the US Open is we could have got paid that money, but it's like now all of a sudden the US Open's double as important as every event because, sorry, but like the money does make the tournaments. I mean, the four majors are legacy and they're the majors, but they're also more money. Like, that's why people work just in general. Like, yeah, we all would love a legacy, but at the same time, one person wins a week. No one gives a shit if you finish 12th, but you do if it's for me, because it's a little bit more money and it, I don't know, maybe if they made the understanding of how many points you get for each finish on FedEx wise, it would help a lot because I could start to value 10th place in points instead of,
but points are money. But
points are money. Yeah, but it's hard. I don't like. I always. I'm trying nowadays. We get a sheet at the end of each week, and you see what place pays what, and then you see what place gives how many points. I'm trying to get an understanding of because you know Kevin Chappell, who's a buddy of mine, has been on a medical and at Waste Management was his last start, and he needed X amount of points. I can't remember what it was, like 12 points, and I was like, I have no idea what place that is. So I had to go up. I went home and like looked up what he needed to finish, and it was like, it's so funny that I'd done this for so many years and I have not one clue. So maybe that would help a little bit, but again, I'm cool with the money, but I know that the top guys, I get it. When you're like the CEO of basically a Fortune 500 company as the athlete that they are, they have to start looking at things in a way, sure. Maybe not have to, but they look at things a little bit differently than me.
No, I greatly appreciate the perspective there because it seems like there is a gap in understanding how things flow amongst tour players and information flowing. I'm not saying that's on the tour players. I'm not saying that's on the tour, but there just seems, I think it's starting to close a little bit, but
yeah,
I don't think Phil has helped with,
no, but I would say, yeah, honestly, Phil didn't help that at all, but I would say that there's more people than are being said or that you would think that are actually looking into those numbers, sitting down with people running through like, hey, are we kind of not making the same scale we should be. So people are looking into it. And those are the people I'm kind of talking to. Now, again, I'm not going to have these big qualms about it until I do it myself. Again, I don't have that big of an interest in it at the moment, but, so you're hearing it from other people, but people are looking into it, man. Like it's not, we're all not just like following Phil's leadership of we are owed $20 billion or right, whatever the hell it is.
And I think with Rory as chairman of the pack, like you got a pretty good, and transparent person that can help bridge that gap among the players. I think, I don't really know how all that governance works exactly, but
it's, that's also the very odd part is because you hear it's a player run organization and I kind of get it, but like at the same time I have a lot of buddies that are on that and it's still pretty hard. It's not like if it was purely player run, like there's a rumor Harry and Joel are going to get fined for having their shirt off on 16 at Waste Management, and like we would vote on that and I think that they wouldn't get them fined, you know. I don't know if they're going to, but like it's hard to have a big say. It has been funny. It's probably not the easiest name now to use as like a fun person to learn from in these meetings, but Charlie Hoffman's a good friend of mine. And you know, he would kind of funnel information so I would know what's going on with the player run organization, because it's, you know, I don't know what's going in all these meetings, but it's nice knowing what his angles on things, because you know, he had basically a firsthand experience of hearing what the executives say, and then he would ask us what we thought, and then he'd bring that to a meeting, you know. So like that's the tough part, is we don't, you know, I don't have a huge voice in this thing, but at the same time I'm also allowed to just run and try to be on the pack, so I'm allowed that opportunity. So maybe I'll do that at some point to, you know, be able to complain with an actual reason, because I'm actually doing something about it. It's like complaining about the president of the United States and you didn't vote. Like, I feel like you give up that right. So I don't complain about, I have things again I'd change, but the finances and the ins, little ins and outs, I don't have much to stand on, because I don't really know anything.
Right. That's where like I have to check myself every now and then, because I feel like I'm taking the side of the tour way too often. But it's like, you know, imagine that you're one of what, 200 members or so. Like, yeah. Your interest versus everyone else too. It's like, it's got to be so hard to satisfy everyone involved with that. But it did. So the Harry and Joel thing, where I'm sitting, It was a great highlight. It was entertaining. The tour steered into it and generated highlight for it and posted it. Yet I still think they should probably be fine. I think Harry even said like 100% I should be fine. Yeah. Like it kind of, I think they actually played that one decently well, assuming they do get fined. Cause it's kind of like, yeah, dude, you probably can't like take your shirt off and whip it around Petey Pablo on the green. But
I mean, the story as it goes is Joel's story is one of the funniest things I've ever heard, because just at the very end, he's like, you know, me and Harry get in the tunnel walking to 17 and we put our clothes back on. And I just started, I'm like, yeah, man. He's like, yeah, it wasn't great. We looked around like, what the hell just happened? But yeah, I mean, they both are taking it in stride. It's all good. I had a problem with the fact that the tour's Instagram is posting it like for 2 days, and it probably, you know, it did probably great numbers for the event. And again, do I think that they should have done it? No. Do I think it's hilarious? Yes. Do I think it's bad for the game? No. But you know, you got to set a precedent at some point of like, you don't want people doing that all the time. It's the same with the beer throwing. Justin Thomas chips in from the back of the green and gets the beers thrown at him. It's like, that's ridiculous. Yeah. Like that's too much. So we need to set some kind of boundary or some kind of wall as to when you can go insane. But it's just like they were kept posting about it. And every time I'd see it, I'm like, I know what you guys are about to do. And it doesn't feel fun. But I know that there's also a disconnect from the tour's social media team to the higher ups who make these rules. So, but yeah, I mean, that it came off as kind of ironic.
I agree.
Contradictory that you guys are praising them while taking money from them for it. So it was icky there, but I also, they 100% deserve to be fined. But
one, the money goes to charity, right? For fines.
Yes.
One, and two, like it, you know, generating the highlights might bring more people watching it, which might bring more sponsorship.
Oh yeah. That's what we talked about. I told Joel, like, we're going to make more money. You're going to make more money personally because of what you did than the money you might get fined. So, but it was, man, that was an all time funny thing.
See, that's great. What, I know we got to wrap here soon, but what's Netflix involvement been like for you so far? Have you shot much with them? Have you gotten an idea of what that's going to look like?
Yeah. You know, it's weird and cool. I still love it. I didn't really know what it was going to entail. I don't think anyone did. There was a wives event at the Waste Management, where the pros, and the husbands or boyfriends caddy for their wives and girlfriends. So we did it. It was so much fun. So Lacey and I were mic'd up for it in our group. I think that would be, it's not gonna be the greatest content you've ever seen, but I thought that was really cool that they did that. And then, our one regret so far is we haven't been mic'd up for a round other than a practice round yet. And they wanted to do it Saturday at Waste Management. And I wish I would have done it, cause it was the most fun round of golf I've ever been a part of. It was surreal. It would have been really cool for people to see. And I kind of, they're still gonna have footage, but it was bananas. So, so that's been cool. I did a practice round mic'd up, at Riviera. I did a lot more content at Riviera just cause it was kind of, as they told me prior, it was going to be kind of a little bit more of maybe a me heavy week, just given my ties to the city and what happened last season. But yeah, I mean, randomly, like I went to a little, Taco Tuesday at Joel's house and I kind of walked in, I'm eating in the corner, I have my dog and, you know, Lacey are eating with there's a lot of people there and we're kind of just hanging out. And then I went over to say bye to Joel and thank him or whatever. And there's like cameras around and a mic and I'm like, oh, this is weird. Like, I'm not ready. I don't know if I'm ready for this one, but trying to get a little more used to it. But on the golf course, that's fine. You don't notice it too much. I mean, when I would come off the course this past week, I have a camera follow me while I kind of signed autographs and said hi to my friends and family, and all that. So it's different, but at the same time, I think they're doing a great job. You're going to see some really cool stuff. I think that Waste Management week is going to be pretty cool, whatever episode that gets put in, because, you know, if people haven't been there, it's the craziest thing you could ever experience. And that Saturday was the craziest day I could have ever imagined. So I think it's going to be cool. I think, you know, they're doing it the right way. They're very polite and ask if it's cool to do things. I'm not super comfortable yet with like all of it, but I'm definitely open to it. You know, I know Joel's been super open to it and I think they've been doing a great job, getting content and whatnot.
Cool. I'm excited to see it, but
it's going to be cool, man. I really think they're going to do a great job.
I agree. I think, you know, we had the guys on and chatted with them about it and their vision for it, I think is, it's going to be good content for golf fans and casual fans as well. So
absolutely. I think it will be more lean for the casual, but I still think that the hardcore fan would enjoy it from what I'm hearing. Like, but I think the casual, like how I view, obviously the Drive to Survive Formula One, like that, I love every episode of those things. I'm not sure, if it's in the golf world, I'm going to be obsessed with each episode of each thing, cause I'll probably know a lot of it, but like for the casual, like, God, that F1 stuff now I'm like entranced by it. It's so cool.
Sweet. All right. We'll let you go, buddy. This was a blast. Thanks for sharing some stories and perspective on some complicated and not so complicated topics. It's greatly appreciated. I know the listeners.
Anytime, man.
It.
Next time there's a dumpster fire of a week, I'll hop back on.
Please. Anytime, man. I can chat golf with you any day of the week. So, thanks again for the time, buddy. We'll chat soon.
All right. See you, Sally.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!